Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Last week, Goldman Sachs repaid the $10 billion in bailout money it owed the Treasury Department. That is good for taxpayers, and judging by the news today, good for Goldman's bankers, too, because they are now free of pay limits. And Goldman is said to be looking at a tidy profit this year, with record-setting bonuses, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Monday. It is the 22nd of June today. But the weather is going to be a lot colder before Wall Street gets around to handing out its bonuses for calendar year 2009. There are reports today, though, that the checks are going to be plenty big, despite the recession and all the turmoil on Wall Street. A report in Britain's Guardian newspaper says Goldman Sachs is looking at a record profit for the year. Record bonuses logically follow from that. And other investment banks that somehow survived the meltdown are raking it in, too. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott explains how that can possibly be.
So let's get this straight. Investment banks got us into this mess by taking excessive risks on subprime loans, and now they're rolling in profits? Analyst David Williams with Fox Pitt Kelton says trading desks thrive in volatile markets. And when corporations and governments have to raise trillions of dollars, investment banks take a cut.
Well, the real economy is obviously suffering. There is an awful lot of activity taking place in the financial marketplace.
With several investment banks either merged or out of business, there's also less competition these days. One bank taking a larger slice of the pie is Goldman Sachs. Goldman declined to comment today on that talk of record bonuses at the firm this year. Greg Larkin with Risk Metrics Group says Goldman was less involved in subprime than other banks, and the firm wants to hold on to top performers.
There are people that are good traders out there. They're talented bankers, they're talented financial analysts, and I think Goldman has a responsibility to be a place where those kinds of people want to work.
Now that banks are making piles of money again, some corporate governance advocates worry they'll forget about reforming the way bankers are paid. Bonuses are typically based on a single year's profits. Paul Hodgson tracks executive compensation at the Corporate Library. He says bonuses should reward long-term performance.
If firms had been thinking about long-term value growth rather than registering yet another year of record earnings, then undoubtedly I think the risks that were taken would not have been taken.
And Hodgson says Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers would still be here today. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Those big Wall Street banks aside, most businesses in this economy are looking everywhere they can to save money, besides laying off millions of people. There are furloughs. Days off without pay is another way to say that. Hourly workers are having some of their hours cut, and increasingly, companies are reducing retirement benefits, benefits that might never come back even when the economy does. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Michael Gallo's employer, a global high-tech firm, recently stopped contributing to his retirement plan, but it's offering him company stock instead. Gallo says stock isn't as good as cash, but
we all have pretty high hopes and expectations for our company, so it's not exactly what we would call super risky.
And Gallo says it's better than nothing. Close to a quarter of all companies in the U.S. are considering eliminating or cutting back the amount of money they kick into their employees' 401k programs. That's according to a new survey released today by Charles Schwab. Michael Sanfrocke at Schwab says for most employers, cutting matching retirement benefits is a last resort.
What we are absolutely hearing is the vast majority are looking to reinstate that match as soon as they can.
Still, millions of workers have seen their retirement benefits slashed, and there's no guarantee they'll be reinstated. For those workers, this raises some unpleasant questions. like his retirement at 65, actually just a pipe dream?
I don't think the dream of retirement is dead, but it is becoming less of a reality for many people.
Christian Weller at the Center for American Progress says downturns often reveal ugly truths about 401k plans, even during the mild 2001 recession.
What we saw was that employers did cut back their matches to 401k plans in the last recession and never really fully restored them.
And Weller doesn't expect this recession to be any different. Ultimately, he believes the country can't afford to build its retirement policies around 401k matching programs that companies can cut anytime they're short on cash. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
All right, so let's see. Trillions for healthcare reform, trillions for bank and financial system bailouts. At those prices, the new climate change bill that Congress is working on would seem to be a relative bargain. Ever since they started debating greenhouse gas emissions on Capitol Hill, we have been inundated with wildly differing estimates of how much a cap-and-trade system is going to cost. Late last week, the Congressional Budget Office weighed in with what is widely considered an authoritative estimate, an estimate that might move the debate forward some. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Some critics have warned that limiting greenhouse gases through emissions trading will end up costing the average American household more than $3,000 a year in higher energy prices. But the latest numbers from the Congressional Budget Office put that figure much lower. CBO says by 2020, proposed climate legislation would cost an average of $175 per household, about $22 billion a year nationwide. Harvard economist Robert Stavins says his own research backs that up.
They ought to be at least debating and discussing honest and real numbers, and CBO here is providing the correct numbers. Whether this is a large amount or a small amount certainly depends upon one's perspective.
From Dan Lashoff's perspective, it's a reasonable expense. He directs the Climate Center at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
They confirm an analysis by the Environmental Protection Agency, which shows that protecting the planet is very affordable.
Lashoff says that $175 net figure takes into account rebates, tax credits, and other consumer paybacks contained in the current legislation. But critics are unmoved. The Michigan congressman who requested the CBO report, Republican Dave Camp, said today the analysis makes clear that national climate legislation is, quote, a new multi-billion-dollar tax on every American family. Camp called it a direct violation of President Obama's promise that families making less than $250,000 a year wouldn't pay higher taxes. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Today was what you'd call a broad-based sell-off on Wall Street. Traders had a firm case of the, oh my, the worst ain't over yet, Willies, a feeling that was backed up by the World Bank. The group said the global outlook is unusually uncertain. The U.S. outlook will be topic A at the Fed's meeting that starts tomorrow in Washington. The troubles in the markets today weren't only with stocks, by the way. Oil gave up almost 4%. Retail gas prices moved lower for the first time in 54 days. A win for consumers, perhaps. Maybe not such a win as an economic indicator. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big attraction at Wimbledon this week isn't the tennis quite yet. The tournament just started today. It's the new retractable roof over center court, functional yet understated in that way the Brits have. Commentator and sports writer John Wertheim wishes one huge part of American sports could be the same way.
Last month, I attended a New York Mets game at Citi Field, Citi being the TARP-assisted bank that still finds $20 million a year to slather its name on a baseball stadium. The outfield walls are adorned with signs for everything from Verizon to Pepsi. I counted 8 logos on the scoreboard alone. My ticket doubled as a coupon for Subway sandwiches. When it comes to sponsorship, the Mets still trail their crosstown rival, the Yankees. At the new Yankee Stadium, where the Mohegan Sun sports bar blocks views from the cheap seats, even the home runs are brought to you by Geico. But at Wimbledon, the only logos there are tiny, tasteful representations for Rolex, the scoreboard provider, IBM, the stats provider, Slazenger, the ball provider, and Robinson's Barley Water, the provider of barley water. And while television pays a premium for weekend broadcast rights, Wimbledon not only starts on a Monday, but schedules no play for the middle Sunday, so they don't disturb the neighborhood on the holiest day of the week. Why does Wimbledon leave so much money on the table, easily tens of millions a year, when other sporting properties do everything short of looking behind bleachers for extra change to boost revenue? When I asked a tournament official, he laughed gently and said, while there are plenty of offers for sponsorship, if the tournament hung banners behind the baseline or sold naming rights to center court, Wimbledon wouldn't be Wimbledon, would it? Yes, there's money to be made from having a business sponsor your mascot or from carving out luxury suites, but there's also equity and tradition and dignity. Wimbledon, quote, doesn't do costings, that is, make its full financials available to ghost journalists, but profits from 2008 exceeded $50 million. This suggests that protecting the brand and keeping Wimbledon Wimbledon has plenty of value as well. In short, sporting event soul is worth something, too. It sure would be nice if more franchises adopted this philosophy, even if it meant that home runs were brought to us by the actual batter that hit them, not by an insurance company.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. His most recent book is called Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played. Send us your thoughts about tennis or whatever you like, really. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The U.S. unemployment rate hit 9.4% last month. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said today it'll probably hit 10% sooner rather than later. For a lot of people, foreign students included, the ones who came here hoping for better jobs, the U.S. may not look like such a land of opportunity these days, and the expats' home countries are working hard to get their best and brightest back. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports that is especially true of the Chinese.
Shanghai makes a powerful first impression. The elevator in the city's newest and tallest skyscraper strikes a space-age note. The theme is obvious. China is the future. Howard Chow heads the China practice at the law firm O'Melveny & Myers. He says for Shanghai to be a world-class financial center, it also needs world-class talent.
A lot of it relies on people, on know-how, on institutions, and on a legal system. And a lot of that still remains to be built.
You start that building by finding China's best and brightest people overseas and luring them back home. We found two such high flyers in the financial district at an upmarket coffee shop.
Green tea, cappuccino.
41-year-old Mr. Lee says he just gave up a gig managing billions for a mutual fund in Atlanta. He came back to China to be a regulator. He says he wants to be part of a thrilling moment in the nation's history.
Maybe 20 years later, my son will ask,
when China grew so fast in 2000-something, where were you? I want to tell him I was in China.
Both Lee and his colleague Mr. Chen were plucked from job fairs in the U.S., run by Shanghai Financial Groups. 34-year-old Chen was targeted for his Wall Street investment banking experience. For all of New York's recent problems, it's still viewed out here as the gold standard.
U.S. capital markets is like in the car stage, China probably bicycle stage. There is no doubt, U.S. is the most advanced market in the world.
Shanghai has declared plans to introduce new financial products, like stock index futures and margin trading. But it needs practitioners like these guys to study and design them. China can't always match their old salaries, but it can tap their patriotism. Again, Mr. Lee.
I have been in America for 10 years.
I was in America for 10 years and didn't make big contributions. This decision gives me a chance to do something.
The Chinese government counted 69,000 returnees last year. That's up 55% from the previous year. Philip Partnow at UBS Securities in Beijing says for these folks, New York or London is no longer the default option.
The way people have thought about their career evolution has changed. That was inevitable as China rises, but I think this financial crisis has probably accelerated that process.
Even so, most of the Chinese students who go to the U.S. stay there. It's just that now America is retaining fewer of them. A new study by researchers at Duke and Harvard universities has the ominous title, America's Loss is the World's Gain. Shanghai is gaining, in part because the quality of life here gets better by the day. Here's Mr. Chen, the Wall Street alum.
Shanghai is an international city already. You can see a lot of Starbucks, subways, cold stones, ice cream shop.
Make no mistake, returnees do face trade-offs. Chen's colleague Lee left his wife and son back in Atlanta because her career is over there. And don't get him started on Shanghai pollution. Moreover, those who come home aren't always welcome. They can face resentment because they earn more than people who didn't train abroad. And they're often treated as outsiders. Zhou Libo is China's most famous stand-up comedian. Part of his regular shtick is to mock the returnees.
Comrades, don't look at these overseas returnees as superstars. They came back because they couldn't make it over there.
The returnees face sky-high expectations once they're back in China. Even so, more and more are returning here, coming home to the new land of opportunity. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, there's a new industry that's growing like a weed here in Los Angeles.
We really want to demonstrate that we are good corporate citizens and that our communities can actually benefit in a tangible way from having medical cannabis dispensaries located in them.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh my, the Dow Industrials lopped off 200 points today, about 2.3%, finished at 8,339. The NASDAQ followed suit, dropped 61 points, 3.3%, closed at 1,766. The S&P 500 shed 28 points, just over 3%, ended the day at 893. Investors were disheartened by the World Bank's prediction that I told you about, that the global economy is going to retract by nearly 3% this year. The news was especially hard on commodity prices, and that hurt shares of aluminum maker Alcoa. It closed almost 9% lower. Oil companies didn't fare much better. Shares of Chevron dried up more than 3%. President Obama signed new tobacco regulations into law today, but there was no coughing fit among investors there. Shares of cigarette giant Altria closed just a fraction below where they started. Over in Europe, same as here, Britain's FTSE was off roughly 2.5%, while the French CAC 40 and German DAX both fell around 3% or so. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for the month of May. In Washington, the Federal Reserve convenes a two-day meeting on the economy and interest rates. And 21 teams compete in the international submarine races continuing in Bethesda. Build is the world's only engineering design competition for human-powered underwater vehicles. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, there's a reason that the big-name consumer product brands are big-name. They've usually got the marketing budget of a high-profile manufacturer behind them. They may or may not actually be better at whatever they're supposed to do, say, getting your clothes clean, but almost always they cost more. And that last point is a tricky one in a down economy. A survey we saw in Advertising Age today says some of the most loyal brand-name customers, the folks who buy things like Crest toothpaste and Tylenol, are rethinking their buying habits. Eric Anderson teaches marketing at Northwestern University. Professor, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Kai.
What does this say, this study, about brands in this recession and consumer loyalty?
I think we're seeing a number of different things, and they're catching the eye of both retailers and manufacturers. And all of the pressure that we saw coming last year in the holiday season is spilling over into this year. Consumers, their pocketbooks are strained, and we're now seeing that start to impact choice of which brands you're making at the grocery store.
In a nutshell, we'd rather spend less on brand X than a little bit more on the premium brand.
That's the trade-off that's a lot more salient. And I think what you're seeing now is consumers sitting there making that trade-off that otherwise maybe they weren't thinking so hard about before.
You mentioned retailers and manufacturers. Is this hitting both of those? I mean, retailers are losing money and manufacturers as well?
It's clearly hitting both the retail sector and the manufacturers. So the retailers who are benefiting are firms like Walmart. They're seeing a surge in sales and definitely an uptick in customers coming to their stores because customers perceive them to be a lot more price competitive. And the same thing's true of manufacturers. The premium manufacturers are starting to see a decrease in their customer base.
Well, let's walk through this then. If my clothes are getting just as clean at $2 a bottle with Brand X, I am not, once this recession is over, going to spend $4 a bottle for Tide.
Well, Kai, what we know from decades of research across past recessions is that customers tend to stick with the brands that they trade down to. And so the advantage for the store brands and the private label brands is they tend to pick up share during these recessions, and customers tend to stick with them after the recession ends. And that's bad news for the manufacturers of the premium brands.
Seems to me the solution then for Procter & Gamble and all these other manufacturers is just to spend more money on advertising. Is that happening?
Well, the question is where the dollar is coming from, and there's been a cut in the advertising budgets as well. So manufacturers are sitting there trying to ration these scarce dollars across consumer promotions, advertising, and try and maintain loyalty. And that's the trap they find themselves in. How do we keep those customers coming back to our brands when we have fewer dollars to allocate towards influencing their behavior?
Yeah. On that loyalty question, is there a cost to manufacturers and retailers other than straight sales? I mean, can we quantify it in other ways?
Well, in the end, it's all about profitability and customers coming back and buying your brands. And the difficult part is a lot of these metrics that firms use to influence behavior, you know, are short-term rather than long-term. So I can discount today, get customers to buy my brand, but will they stick with me in the future? Will they be around to buy my brand when I don't offer them a deep discount of 30 or 40% off?
What's your guess? I mean, based on what you know about American consumers, what's your guess as to what we're going to do?
I think if you are a brand and you're trying to influence customers' behavior, you might shift away from promotion budgets where you're spending your money on promotions and towards advertising messages that tie into themes that consumers are very concerned about right now, like the environment.
Eric Anderson is a professor of marketing at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. Professor, thanks a lot.
Great. Hope that helped you, Kai.
There are now three states in the union in which it's legal to buy marijuana for medicinal purposes. Last week, Rhode Island joined California and New Mexico as places where pot can be dispensed with a doctor's prescription. The Rhode Island Department of Health will be able to license three medical marijuana dispensaries in total. In some places, like in California and Los Angeles, you can find that many pot clubs in a single block. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more now on an industry with not much regulation and plenty of demand.
In some Los Angeles neighborhoods, there are more medical marijuana dispensaries than there are Starbucks or McDonald's. Most sell more varieties of weed than Baskin-Robbins has ice cream flavors. City Councilman Dennis Zine says calling it a boom is an understatement.
It's bigger than a boom. It's a major explosion with the facilities opening up, and they're opening up every single day in the city of Los Angeles.
At last count, there were more than 650 medical pot clinics in Los Angeles. That's right, 650 plus. For many of them, the medical angle is nothing more than a pretext for selling dope. There's a cottage industry for doctors who prescribe pot for conditions as ubiquitous as insomnia or anxiety. Zine says the city council is working on new regulations to crack down on these freewheeling pot pharmacies. Many will be closed.
Oakland, for example, has four medicinal marijuana facilities. That's easy to regulate and control. When you have 600, you can't regulate and control. We will bring this down to a reasonable number.
While the city tries to curb the growth of pot clinics, the marijuana economy in California seemingly can't be stopped. Nobody really knows what it's worth, but some estimate that marijuana is a $14 billion industry in the state. The THC Expo, the first pot industry trade show in the nation, was held recently at the Los Angeles Convention Center. Hundreds of exhibitors showcased everything from bongs to pot-laced fruit drinks and cannabis candy bars.
It's a great growth industry. Anybody who's interested in a career, there's a great future in cannabis.
That's Steve D'Angelo, executive director of Harborside Health Center, a dispensary in Oakland. In the midst of the recession, he's hiring workers.
The number of new patients coming into my facility climbed 84% in the first 4 months of this year. And what's driving that growth is that we're seeing the very beginnings of the conversion of the huge illegal market for cannabis into a legal market for cannabis.
To be clear, pot has not been legalized, but the Obama administration has taken a hands-off approach to medical marijuana. D'Angelo says gross sales at just his clinic run around $20 million a year, though he quickly reminds me that, by law, medicinal pot clinics are not for profit. To really cash in, D'Angelo recommends starting an ancillary business. He charges up to $400 an hour as a consultant to budding pot entrepreneurs.
How do you develop a competitive edge so that people come to your shop instead of going to other shops?
To help dispensaries boost business, Steep Hill Medical Collective provides pot quality control. It tests for pathogens like molds and mildews and quantifies the level of THC, the active ingredient in pot. Co-founder Addison DeMora says the lab tests help consumers be better informed.
What we're actually doing is allowing patients to pinpoint the cannabis that's more specific for some of their ailments. Kind of gives them a more of a value for their dollar that they're spending at a collective.
He says varieties like Bubba Kush and Granddaddy Purple Indica are good for severe pain, while Sour Diesel and Super Silver Haze Sativas may reduce anxiety. Cash-strapped cities may also see value in weed. In Oakland, pot clinics are behind a ballot measure that would impose a new tax on everything related to medical marijuana. Again, dispensary owner Steve D'Angelo.
We really want to demonstrate that we are good corporate citizens and that our communities can actually benefit in a tangible way from having medical cannabis dispensaries located in them.
In July, voters will decide on the tax. If approved, Oakland could collect around $300,000 in pot taxes to help the city's budget. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, there was some sad news from the world of photography today, specifically for devotees of actual film. And yet, with apologies to Paul Simon, Kodak did take the Kodachrome away today. The company announced it's retiring its 74-year-old brand. It's hard to process, it seems. It accounts for less than a single percent of the company's still picture sales anyway. And oh, by the way, it's not digital. Still, and I'm a digital guy, it is kind of sad, don't you think? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow fell 200 points, nearly 3%. The NASDAQ dropped 61 points, 3 2/3%. The S&P 500 lost 28 points, just over 3% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona. And Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the broadcast, imagine, if you can, a world without credit cards.
Forcing people to save and plan. And by the time they actually plan and save to purchase an item, they may decide that they really don't need it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.